To celebrate Halloween, we put together a spooky bonus weekend podcast. In 2015, Margie Kerr, a sociologist, talked about her book Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. I spoke with Stacey Schiff in 2015 about her book The Witches, Salem 1692. And Alice Cooper came on the show in April to discuss his narration of Peter and the Wolf in Hollywood. Get your candy, pull on your headphones, and enjoy. Fear is an impulse designed to warn about potential danger, but why then do certain people seek out the feeling of being scared? People like skydivers or roller coaster lovers and horror movie buffs. On today's Please Explain, we will learn about the science of fear, why and how we experience it, and why some people think it's fun. And we are joined by Margie Kerr, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, a nationally recognized expert on professional haunted houses. Her book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear, is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. So good to be on. Thank you.
And if members of our audience want to join the conversation, give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Margie, when you're not teaching, don't you work at Scare House in Pittsburgh, one of the most frightening haunted houses?
I do, yes. It's not the most common side job for professors, but it's been incredibly enlightening.
But this is not a typical haunted house. You say it's not covered in blood and guts like the traditional kind. What's it like in there?
Yeah, the Scare House does have a little bit of the gore, but just a little bit. It's a more sort of creepy and very sort of immersive experience. A lot of the sets are so highly designed that you can't help but get completely engaged in the environment. For example, the first haunted house within the Scare House is all set in 1932, and all of the props, all of the designs, the artifacts, the wallpaper is authentic to that time period. So it's an incredibly immersive experience.
You've said that the first time you visited it, you got so spooked you ran into a wall and hurt your shoulder.
I did, yes.
What spooked you?
I have never encountered characters like they have at Scare House.
And you're a sociologist.
Yes.
How did you become a consultant for Scare House?
Well, I was working on my dissertation. This was probably about 8 years ago. And I was just so sort of engrossed in all of my research and data for my dissertation, and I really wanted to, you know, get out of my house, get out of my head for a while. And I went to Scare House because I love haunted houses and always have. And I was talking to the owner and said, you know, this place is amazing. I just want to be here all the time. And he said, well, what do you do? And I explained that I was a sociologist. And it turned out that they had a lot of data that needed to be analyzed. They'd been collecting data from their customers for years, and they had basic descriptive statistics, but nothing really that was looking at the more qualitative answers and the open-ended questions. So I came in and did that, and it really just took off in a completely new direction for me.
So you can learn all sorts of things in a haunted house that you can't learn doing research in a lab?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it's in the real world. It's still, you know, a false environment, a haunted house. You know, everything is fake, but it does get you a little bit closer to people experiencing emotions in real life. You know, lab environments are so sterile, and they're constantly, under the participants are constantly aware that they are in a research setting, and so this, you know, really allowed me to see people reacting in real time to, you know, real stimuli. And I felt just so lucky to be able to see those reactions that really were so genuine.
Now, I'm assuming fear is an emotion like other kinds of emotions. Is it related to other emotions?
Yeah, emotions really, you know, what we call emotions, a lot of it is in the meaning making that we give to whatever sort of physical experiences that we're having. So, you know, that's why you can see people who scream, but then they immediately laugh. And it's because there's a similar arousal response happening in our body, and it's just that the context has changed or the meaning around it has changed. So, you know, the emotions really are the cognitive processing that we are doing to sort of make sense of what we're experiencing. So at a physiological level, we're going to see a lot of similarities between, you know, states of fear and states of, you know, excitement or even happiness, or, you know, the basic kind of high arousal states all share these common components. But the names that we give that experience can change based on whether we feel safe or we feel like we're in real danger.
So the word thrilling is usually used as a positive.
Yeah, and that's why I talk a lot about, you know, thrills and chills, because the underlying response in the body is so similar, and it's just the again, sort of what we are making of that moment. For example, on a roller coaster, we've got our threat response is happening too, but a lot of people don't think of that in the, you know, traditionally sort of scary in the haunted sense. They think of it more as thrilling and positive, but it's the same sort of underlying response.
You have spent a lot of time doing various scary activities, like spending a night in an abandoned prison, going on the steepest roller coaster in the world.
Yeah.
One seems more psychologically scary, while the other seems to be more of a physical experience.
Yeah, in my book, I separate out sort of the psychological, you know, fear and the physical thrill, because they are we do give them different meaning. And, you know, when I spent the night at Eastern State Penitentiary, which is a historic site now, it really takes you to a different type of fear, a fear, you know, that is more about, you know, real people and, you know, sort of the human capacity to both, you know, hurt others, and also what happens when we're sort of in states of isolation. So really taking fear into the mind and seeing how we can think ourselves into a state of physical fear.
Didn't the NIH recently develop a document on fear and other emotions?
They did. They developed a document to sort of guide research in emotions that outlined the difference between things like, you know, acute threat and what sort of the target, study items would be, and things like chronic stress and, you know, just general negative affect, and trying to sort of bring some consistency, because it is, you know, how people define fear can change so much based on time and place. And so researchers really want to have a common language when they say, okay, we're talking about, you know, the acute threat response. We're talking about, you know, what's happening in the body in that moment of startle, versus let's talk about what's happening in the body that's been under a chronic state of stress. You know, what's changing, you know, over time versus in the moment. And I think that's really helping to separate, you know, what's happening in the body versus what sort of meaning people are giving to these experiences, and just sort of trying to make sure everybody's talking about the same thing as much as possible.
I'm speaking with Margie Kerr. Her book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Well, I would think that fear mostly resides in the brain, but we have these physical responses like sweating, increased heart rate, sometimes even incontinence. Are they linked together? Is what happening in the brain then sending messages to other parts of the body?
Yeah. So when we're afraid, when we go into that threat response, our brain is just trying to process as much information as possible. And we've got, you know, the emotional processing parts of our brain, the amygdala, the insula, the hippocampus, everything sort of trying to sound the alarm to get the body prepared to fight or flee. So it's triggering the release of all different types of hormones and neurotransmitters. And while that's happening, a lot of the sort of executive functioning, the rational thinking, the logical thought, all of those messages are being put on the back burner because the goal is survival. And research has found is that really good kind of emotional regulation happens when the communication between the thinking part of our brain, so that executive functioning and the prefrontal cortex, when communication between that and this, you know, more emotional processing part of the brain is strong. So you've got your rational logic coming in and saying, you're on a roller coaster, you're fine, you're in a safe place, you know, you can stop sounding the alarms, we're okay, and it, you know, can result in more sort of regulation and not going into the complete, you know, panic mode where you just have, you know, no concept of what's happening at all. But that does happen because, you know, when we're really terrified, the primary goal is to make sure our body is capable of getting out, getting away, and surviving.
From a biological standpoint, can a perceived threat be the same as a potential harm that's actually there?
Yeah, we can think ourselves into an extreme state of panic, and that, you know, we see happen with things like PTSD or really any if you're just, say, for example, sitting alone at home one night and you hear a bang outside, and it's probably nothing, probably, you know, just the wind, but if your mind starts taking you to all of those places that sort of tap into all of the horror movies that you've seen, and all of a sudden you're imagining someone is outside your window and trying to get in, we can work ourselves into a state where we believe that we are in, you know, extreme threat and danger, and it's an amazing, you know, ability of the human brain to do this, to basically, you know, using our imagination, get our body into such a state of high arousal.
And this is something that is an evolutionary development. I don't know whether animals have similar kinds of dual responses, but I'd imagine that they do.
Well, every species has a threat response, a sort of defense mechanism to make sure that they can protect themselves when they're being threatened. In terms of the processing that's happening, that's a little less clear and much more difficult to study what kind of meaning they're bringing to their physical experiences.
My guest is Margie Kerr, who is a sociologist. She teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. She's also a nationally recognized expert on professional haunted houses and works year-round at the Scare House Haunted House, analyzing data on customers and employees to make its attractions even scarier. Well, she's written a book called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. It is published by Public Affairs. And we will continue our conversation if we take a little break. We're back with Margie Kerr, her book Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. It's published by Public Affairs. You cite a study in your book from the University of Virginia that found that most people would rather be doing something bad, like intentionally shocking themselves, than sitting alone with their thoughts.
Yes.
that struck me as odd, although I have heard that in the early days of treatment of autistic children, a Skinner-type doctor would give a little electric shocks to the autistic kids who weren't doing what he wanted them to do. And then they discovered that the kids were actually not doing things on purpose because they were stimulated by the shocks.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I know that there are researchers following up on that study and looking at it more to try and figure out exactly, you know, why we're doing this. At first, you know, we like to explore novel things, and so we're going to be curious to see, oh, what does this feel like, and try it. But the fact that we then continue to do it is, you know, very fascinating and suggests that we are gaining something from it. And, you know, the physical response or activating sort of physical sensation is a really great way to distract yourself from what's happening in your brain. You know, we're in the terms of hierarchy of attention, we're going to pay attention to what's happening to our body first. And so it could be potentially very therapeutic in a way if you're, you know, using sort of a external stimulation to sort of reset whatever you're thinking about. In fact, Greg Siegel at the University of Pittsburgh, he's looking at how that could, you know, potentially be beneficial to use, you know, physical stimulation through very mild electric shock to sort of take people out of negative rumination cycles of thinking sort of these continuously kind of negative thought patterns. But it is interesting that we, you know, that just everyday people would rather shock themselves than sit alone with their thoughts.
Wow. One listener wonders whether you make a distinction between fear and terror. Is there a difference? And what is it?
I don't know that there's, I think that the difference is largely going to be subjective, you know, for people who are creating their own, I guess, range of fear, you know, if they say go from, you know, thrilling to scary to fearful to terrifying, that's going to be a very subjective kind of range. In terms of looking at it physiologically, you know, that could depend on, you know, the individual too, and what their normal rates of different types of hormones or, you know, just I don't think that the difference is going to be, you know, meaningful in terms of, you know, research.
Let's take some calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Edward from Queens, you're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon. How you doing?
Okay. What's your question?
Basically, I just had a question for the guest. Is it, you hear the term, or I've heard the term, a person is fearless or man without fear, something like that. Is it actually physiologically possible to have someone born without that fear response or train yourself to not react to have a physiological or emotional response to fear? Is that just a saying or is that possible?
Well, let me add to this. You write that 100% of people experience height-related physical symptoms, and yet not everybody's afraid of height. And tightrope walkers, like somebody like Philippe Petit, he walked a tightrope across the tops of the World Trade Towers when they still existed. So was he fearless?
Well, you know, there's a famous research participant that was just referred to as SM, who had damage in her amygdala, who, you know, was essentially fearless in a way because, you know, that you know, part of her brain was not working, you know, to alert her to, you know, situations, things that would be scary. But the idea of sort of training ourselves to become fearless, you know, we absolutely can bring a lot of emotional regulation to our fear response, and definitely people who, you know, are doing these incredibly, you know, dangerous things like high rope, tightrope walking are exerting a tremendous amount of regulation to be able to do that. So you can train yourself and sort of increase that communication between, you know, your thinking brain and your sort of emotional response. But the things like the height, mentioning that, you know, 100% of people will experience height-related symptoms is just a matter of what our body is physically able to tolerate. So we may not be afraid of it, but our body is definitely going to have a response to being so far up in the air or, you know, hundreds of feet underwater. There are some things that our body just can't tolerate, and so we'll, you know, go into a kind of a threat response or physiological response. But
I'm assuming if a lion is about to pounce on us, for example.
Yeah, and you know the that automatic response to prepare is what has kept us alive for years and years, well, forever. And the benefits, though, of learning about your own fear response and being able to bring a control to it is extremely beneficial, because then it does allow us to quickly assess a situation and make good decisions by, you know, bringing in that rational thinking and saying, okay, this is a real threat, this is how I should respond, or, you know, okay, this is not something I need to be so worried about, and sort of move on.
Let's take a call from Jean Marie from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Leonard. Thank you so much for having me. Actually, it's interesting because making this call certainly elicits a little fear response in me, but I was calling because I was thinking about the proximity between fear and irritation. Because my personal experience, I become hyper rational when I'm in actually dangerous situations, and I've been in quite a few. I was in Iraq making a film about the history and sociology of Mesopotamian cuisine, and I ended up being, you know, completely alone. I went without any security. And so I was in a lot of areas where they hadn't seen anybody, any Westerners, for 5 years. And that was fine, but I had a few situations there where I thought that I was just trapped with civilians all the time. I was clearly in areas I shouldn't be in. But I become very hyper-rational. And I was in Syria once, and I was arrested for filming, and I was just able to completely have a very decent, rational conversation with the minister where I was arrested, and I end up getting their protection. So I handle real fear in really scary situations in a hyper-rational way. But I always say I feel more calm being chased by a Mossad agent than I do getting on the phone with Verizon.
Uh-huh. What about going to a horror film?
I hate horror films. Mm. I loathe and despise them.
So we pick and choose. Is that how we work, Margie?
Yeah, and, you know, that's an amazing skill that you have. And that's, I think, something that, you know, most people would probably really love to be able to do, to be able to essentially, you know, say, okay, the thing that I need the most right now is my mind in this situation. You know, so many of the threats throughout our you know, history have been to our physical body from, you know, predators or things like that. But in many of the big, you know, scary situations today, it is our minds that we need to have ready to go. So that is a great skill to have. And, you know, we can, once we sort of do bring such an awareness to what we're afraid of and how we respond, you know, choose which to engage with, which to sort of allow our suspension of disbelief. So, for example, if you want to be scared going into a haunted house, to say, okay, I know this is fake, but I'm going to go ahead and allow myself to be scared. You can do that. You know, you can make that sort of choice to engage or not. And that is something I see a lot, you know, watching people go through haunted houses, those who come up and say, oh, I'm not going to be scared. I'm not going to, you know, let anything touch me. And they sort of steel themselves even against the startles. And it is sort of a skill that we can develop. And in that context, it always makes me sad, because then they're missing out on the fun of it if they enjoy it. But for those who really don't like that feeling, the sensation, or the content, then being able to say, I just don't want to engage, can, you know, also be, you know, really helpful. And then typically people will avoid things like scary movies and haunted houses.
Michael from Teaneck, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm just wondering, is one's affinity for or aversion to horror movies and frightening things in general a good indicator of maybe their overall bravery? And then would that correlate to maybe what jobs they seek or be good at? Cop, firefighter, that sort of thing. That's what I was wondering.
So do you find that cops love horror, love going into the haunted house?
You know, I have not collected employment data on participants or customers, but now I really want to. These are the kind of questions that I would love to have a lot of data on, because I think it is really interesting, you know, if we do find that there are correlations between engagement with voluntary engagement with scary material and things like employment or things like sort of bravery or courage. And a lot of it is going to come down to sort of the measurements that we use. How do we measure it? And right now there are many scales that look at things like sensation seeking or need for affect or the thrill seekers to try and assess that. And then, you know, we also, there isn't much data then connecting that to what's happening with the rest of the life of people who are sort of fitting a certain profile to see how it's affecting their self-esteem. And that's actually part of the study that I'm working on right now is, you know, administering both the need for affect and sensation seeking, and then also asking questions about sort of how they feel about themselves and, how they feel about themselves before and after doing something scary to see how it's impacting their overall sense of well-being. And, you know, potentially is this, you know, helping them build a sense of resilience, a sense of confidence in themselves.
Jack from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was wondering if you had any comment about phobias, which certainly are fear-inducing, generally over something that other people would find totally innocuous.
Yeah, phobias are, you know, we can condition ourselves or be conditioned to develop a phobia of practically anything. Many times it just takes one negative experience with something to, you know, solidify that as a scary thing in our mind, and then take into the pathological sort of extreme, it becomes a phobia. And there are many methods now that psychologists can use, therapists can use to do a desensitization so that you can overcome your phobia. And there's definitely interventions out there now that are effective and can work.
I have a friend who screams every time she sees a snake in a movie. And she believes it's something genetic in her, that some people just have a gene to protect themselves against those kinds of dangerous situations.
Yeah, there's been some research on that. There's actually a theory called snake detection theory that is trying to, you know, study whether or not this is a sort of hardwired fear. And I don't believe that they are quite there yet. You know, snakes are inherently kind of unsettling because they're so unpredictable and they can move rapidly, and so they have a lot of characteristics that can scare us. But in terms of having sort of a gene for snakes or sort of being hardwired for it, as recently as I've read, they haven't yet found that gene.
A listener, Brian, writes, does the experience of fear vary in different cultures and demographics?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what we fear changes based on time and place. The monster as metaphor is a great sort of example of this. You can see each culture is going to have their dominant monsters that largely reflect what's happening in that society and in a time and place. For example,
you write about Japan in your book
a
lot.
Yeah, in Japan, many of the most popular scary stories revolve around ghosts and really focus on the afterlife and the powerful ghosts that can come in and really destroy lives. And it's very much linked to a lot of the culture and tradition and the religion, and that's, you know, then reflected in the stories that we tell. Similarly, when I was in Bogota, a lot of the stories were also about ghosts, but the ghosts were actually representations of, you know, evil drug lords or dictators or, you know, paramilitary groups, and using the ghost stories was really a way of sort of sharing what was happening in real life. You know, what we are afraid of is going to be a reflection of what's happening in society. And that's really, there have been many books written sort of tracing American, history through the monster tales. And you can kind of see what our fears are reflecting, whether it's, you know, fear of technology in the form of lots of robot movies, or if it's fear of, you know, alien invaders as we, you know, embark upon space exploration. It's, you know, we can turn our fears into monsters and fight them on screen and feel triumphant.
Do we know why so many children fear the monster under the bed or in the closet?
Well, you know, children's imaginations, you know, are just going wild. They're experiencing so many things for the first time, and just imagining just everything. The world is a big unknown, and so, you know, to imagine that there could be these creatures is sort of a natural part of that coming to understand the world and everything around you. And also, a lot of times for kids, you know, when they're in bed alone, that's often their first experience of being by themselves. You know, throughout the day, they're probably with a parent or at school, but at night, they're getting that sense for the first time, wow, I'm alone, I'm by myself. And so it creates a real feeling of vulnerability.
Margie Kerr is a sociologist teaching at the University of Pittsburgh. She's also an expert on fear and haunted houses and related matters. She's been featured on Science Friday and in various publications. Now she's written a book called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. It's published by Public Affairs. Margie, thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain segment.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
It began in 1692 in Massachusetts when a minister's daughter and his niece began to scream and convulse. It ended less than a year later after 20 men and women and two dogs had been executed for the crime of witchcraft. The Salem witch trials are well known, but perhaps not as well understood. Stacy Schiff, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, Saint Exupery, and Cleopatra, A Life, examines the legal and social ramifications of the Salem trials in her latest book from Little Brown called The Witches, Salem 1692. I'm very pleased to welcome Stacy Schiff back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you, Leonard.
Why do we continue to be fascinated by the Salem witch trials, which took place over 300 years ago? Do you think it's because women so rarely play a central role in the stories of American history?
You know, I think it has something to do with that. There's a reversal, clearly, of gender roles here. But I think, interestingly, we go back to it for the same reason that it happens in the first place, which is that the unresolved really irritates us. And we don't like not to have a diagnosis. We don't like not to have an answer. And this is really the sort of ultimate locked room, closed room mystery in American history.
What are some of the most common misconceptions about the trials?
I think most of us assume it to have been a misogynistic moment in American history where the accusations are being leveled by men against women. And the truth is actually quite different. It's first of all, it's a group of pubescent and prepubescent girls who are doing the accusing. And they're accusing both men and women. Five of the hanging victims are men. One of them is a minister, in fact. The hangings, I think, come as a surprise to many people. I think the common perception is that we burned our witches. In fact, witches did burn, but not in New England. So everyone is hanged. I think
except one who's crushed to death.
Crushed. It's the most horrible.
How did that happen?
He's the one suspect who refuses to enter a plea in court. And the price. And I found this very rarely in the record, but it has threatened in other cases. The price to be paid for that for not entering a plea is to be forced to enter a plea. And in this case, it's a really pretty grisly moment. He's spread out in the jail yard and stones are piled atop him exactly until he speaks, which he doesn't, and therefore dies in that posture. His wife actually hangs as a witch shortly thereafter.
That's kind of like burning the auto da fe, where if you survive, then you are a witch. We didn't prove that any of these people were witches at the time.
No, but you're right in the sense that no one comes out. No one who goes into that courtroom fails to come out convicted. It's 100% conviction rate.
Now, this was a time when the colonists were fighting the Indians a lot. That's another part of the story that we rarely hear about.
Yeah, I think there are three things actually about New England at that moment that are pretty much lost on us. First of all, this is not Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. These are our fundamentalist ancestors. These people are deeply and devoutly religious, and they have built this sort of biblical commonwealth on the edge of a frontier. And I think the darkness and the fragility of that frontier are lost on us today.
Did the 1689 revolt in Boston create tension between the Puritans we're discussing here and the Church of England?
It creates a huge tension, really, between the colonial authorities and the crown. So that what you have in the 3 years prior to the witchcraft is, first of all, a colony that's operating without a charter. So it's an extremely sort of dislocated time politically.
Were they all Puritans?
Pretty much. There are some Baptists. There are some Quakers. We know about them because, of course, the Puritans derided them so much. It's largely a Puritan commonwealth, although not everyone is in meeting as often as he or she should be. But there's an enormous amount of uncertainty in the air because of the political dislocation.
It almost feels like a cult. I mean, when we look at it today in terms of modern cults, this closed society mm-hmm. with its own rules. And also exclusion of outsiders. Can we think of it in those terms?
Well, you know, there's an interesting parallel there in the sense that everyone's on the same page. There is no, and it took me a few minutes to realize this, wait, I'm writing about the 17th century and there were no newspapers yet in Massachusetts. Everyone is hearing the same message. They're hearing it from the sermon. That's the sole, there was no Leonard Lope. That's the sole means of broadcast journalism. And they're imbibing the same images.
And how would they have defined a witch?
A witch to them, unlike a witch to us, was a creature, man or woman, who had signed a pact with the devil. This is a diabolical accomplice, and who can perform unnatural acts because of the power that the devil grants him or her. And there were telltale signs. You had signs on your body. You often had animal accomplices, which is why those two dogs are executed.
Isn't this kind of late for thinking about witchcraft? It had been a big spasm in England almost a century before, but that ended.
And that speaks to what you just asked about, is this a sort of cult? At this moment, Massachusetts is largely, it's in a world of its own. It's very insular. It's kind of cut off from the mother country. And it is controlled largely by the ministers and the authorities who have not allowed the news that perhaps there are skeptics about witchcraft to penetrate Massachusetts libraries.
How much do we have in writing of this time? Did the girls keep diaries?
On the one hand, we have a huge amount, mountains of Puritan sermons, which I can recite for you if you'd like. And on the other hand, we have things, we have complete lacuna in the records. We have nothing in the voice of any of these girls who are clearly in grave misery, and we have nothing in terms of the court transcripts. We have preliminary hearings, but not the actual court records.
The transcripts were destroyed?
It would seem to be, but obviously we have no proof of that. They're not. The common wisdom is that in the Stamp Act riot in the 18th century, they disappear. That they may have been tossed into the street and lost that way.
How much of a source are the two important players, the father and son team of Increase and Cotton Mather, in what we know about this time?
Well, repeatedly the authorities, who are a little bit unsure how to prosecute these cases. I mean, this is an epidemic of witchcraft, the likes of which no one has seen before. And it builds, it's not just witchcraft, it builds into this diabolical conspiracy to really subvert the church and the state. And the authorities are unclear as to how exactly to prosecute it and how to analyze the evidence of witchcraft. And they repeatedly appeal to the ministers in Massachusetts, in this case, Increase Mather, who would have been the most eminent, and his 29-year-old son, Cotton. So they're at the center, really, the nerve center here.
Increase was the president of Harvard. So Harvard then was a Puritan school?
Yes, and it's graduating ministers. And what's interesting here, of course, is that these men, both the witchcraft judges, those in power, and most of the ministers themselves, are, of course, the best read men in Massachusetts. So the people who are analyzing witchcraft, who are prosecuting the cases, are all of them the most erudite men in the colony.
And they write extensively.
They write extensively. I wish they had written more personally, but they write extensively. And moreover, they've read extensively and possibly too much.
Why did they get involved in the Salem witch trials? What did they hope to gain from their rigorous support of it?
Well, you know, it's interesting with this story, Leonard. Everyone has an agenda. And from the point of view of the authorities, there's a great deal here to be said for, first of all, appeasing the masses. And they're very worried about some kind of mob uprising. There's a sense here that the public order needs to be restored, especially after the last couple of charterless years. There is a new charter that has just arrived in 1692, and this is a fledgling administration, and it has every reason to want to prove itself, to be a very capable law and order administration, and B, for that new charter really to feel legitimate in some way.
Were father and son, Increase and Cotton, in agreement, or Do they sometimes contradict each other?
Well, there you ask a very complex question. They on the page, they seem to disagree with each other, but they seem to disagree with themselves as well, which is interesting. I mean, especially Cotton Mather is really speaking out of both sides of his mouth when he's asked questions by the judges about the legitimacy of witchcraft. But yes, it does seem as the summer wears on and as the witchcraft intensifies, that there seems to be some sort of disagreement, or that the two seem to go their separate ways. They paper over that difference, but it does seem as if the father is saying, let's not persecute quite as extensively as we're doing, and the son is making less of a case for mercy.
My guest is Stacy Schiff, whose latest book is The Witches, Salem, 1692. The story began with two young girls, Betty Paris and Abigail Williams, who were 9 and 11 years old. What happened to them?
Ultimately, we don't know, which, of course, is one of the downsides of not having any diaries or any papers from these girls. One of them seems to grow up and live a perfectly normal life, and the other one disappears from the record. And the afflictions that which they suffer, which are then thought to be witchcraft, the trances, the strangling, the writhing, the contortions, continue throughout most of the summer for the elder. The younger one really disappears from the story.
Arthur Miller changed 11-year-old Abigail into a 17-year-old in The Crucible. Do you have any idea why?
He needed to create a sexual liaison for one of the tensions in the story. It actually makes perfect sense, and he couldn't quite bring himself to do that with a younger girl. I'm not sure if that makes it for a better. It certainly makes for a better play. There were certainly sexual tensions at work here. Few of them documented. There's a lot of hints. It's rippling under the surface here in the testimony, but there's nothing quite as palpable as what Miller used.
Are we talking about repressed sexual tensions?
You know, if you look at the court record, you see a tremendous, you just see a huge number of assaults on women, and lots of women fending themselves off from the advances, from unwanted advances. Lots of women walking into barns, into bedrooms, and finding that they're under assault by men.
In a culture that's obsessed with sin?
You know, fornication was a big seller in 17th century Massachusetts, I'm here to tell you, having read the court records. Yes, in that culture. But there's clearly a certain amount of preying on women. There are terrible stories of young servant girls living in houses at extremely young ages being assaulted and abused by masters and by other men in the house. So how much of that plays a role in this cohort of suffering girls is hard to say, but a lot of the imagery and the language does have a sort of sexual connotation.
Betty Paris and Abigail Williams's father and uncle was the minister Samuel Paris. How did he interpret their behavior?
Well, you know, Paris is an interesting character in that he's very doctrinaire, he's very crisp, he doesn't have a lot of social grace, but he doesn't jump immediately to the conclusion that it's witchcraft. Once he does, he begins preaching very inflammatory sermons, which of course does nothing but ignite the entire crisis and move it along quite effectively. He's determined that there are therefore devils within his church, and he's very willing to help point fingers.
And the doctor who examined the girls gave them a supernatural diagnosis. Would that have been common?
It interestingly would have been, because their symptoms, several years earlier there had been a very similar case with identical symptoms, and those girls too had been, those children, there was a young boy as well, had been diagnosed as suffering from witchcraft. This was a Boston case. And in that case, 1688, the woman who is, it's an older woman in the neighborhood, hangs on Boston Common. And that account, which Cotton Mather had written up, is an account that's extremely familiar to everyone in Salem in 1689. So it may play something of a role here.
Would the diagnosis today be clinical hysteria or just kids acting out looking for attention?
Well, you know, not having personally observed the girls, it's a little bit difficult to say. Something is clearly very wrong, and they are clearly suffering very deeply. It sounds like what we would today call hysteria or conversion disorder, certainly. In all ways, it corresponds to some sort of deep psychic wound that they are unable to... I mean, they're smothering their words. They're unable to express whatever this great anguish is.
And once accusations start flying, more and more people make accusations. But interestingly, a number of people admit to being witches.
A huge number of people confess to witchcraft. And in fact, that's what moves the story along, because once one of the first three suspects will confess, and once she has confessed, then there seems to be ample evidence that there really is witchcraft here at work. And then it's impossible to deny this narrative, which begins to build and become quite detailed and convoluted about this diabolical conspiracy. And fingers begin to point among parents and children and ministers and their parishioners. It's, you know, it's an extraordinary amount of betrayal within the communities.
The governor of Massachusetts established a special court to try the witchcraft cases. Was he a Puritan?
He's a late arriver in the Puritan Church. He meets the Mathers at a very crucial point in his life and becomes a church member largely at their urging for political reasons. So is he a true believer? Hard to say. He's certainly an expedient Puritan.
Tell us about the legal proceedings. Didn't the afflicted girls twitch and shriek and go into convulsions in the courtroom?
You begin to see why the parents are quite so concerned. I mean, this is a difficult set of symptoms to live with. These girls are really in agony, and they're loud and they're writhing. In the courtroom, when they did this, it was only further proof that the suspect was guilty. It was like having a corpse in the courtroom. Here were these girls in the presence of this person, unable to control themselves. Many of them appeared in the courtroom with pins sticking out of there. We actually have an image of the book of the purported pins that were sticking out of hands and knees, and in one case, the hair of a girl. In one case, a big spot of blood begins to bloom on one of the girls' bonnets. They're obviously afflicted in the presence of the people whom they've accused of witchcraft.
And couldn't a conviction rest purely on spectral evidence, testimony about invisible ghosts and witches?
That was one of the things that made the justices appeal to the Mathers for advice. Spectral evidence is evidence that is visible only to the bewitched, and that is what the conviction here has to rest on. So what's interesting is that the girls will point to something, and they'll point to an assailant, or they'll point to a person whom they say is sitting on the beams of the meeting house, and everyone else seems to see him or her too.
The first convicted witch, Bridget Bishop, was hanged in June 1692. Was that a public hanging?
Yes. The whole point of a hanging in 1692 or in the 17th century was that it was a public spectacle. It was a performance. It was a cautionary tale. It was amusement to some extent. I think that was fairly true in the 17th century, regardless of where you lived.
Did people feel reassured when the witches were executed?
I think there's a huge sense of relief that you have in some way purged your society of an element that the authorities have determined is malicious or is noxious in some way, sure.
20 people were executed and a couple of dogs, although I don't understand how that worked. But how many others
were? I can tell you later.
How many were accused of witchcraft? Were many imprisoned as well?
The number's a little bit variable because, of course, the record is somewhat faulty, but somewhere more than 140 and fewer than 250 people are accused. And the interesting part, of course, is that we refer to these as the Salem Witch Trials, but much of Essex County, in fact, is affected. There are 24 communities in which people are said to be practicing witchcraft.
A man named George Burroughs was believed to be the ringleader, the demonic mastermind. What was he accused of?
He's accused of being a conjurer, which the girls claim is in a new distinction, is above a wizard. I mean, he's given this extraordinary rank. And it's actually interesting in a case which we think of as misogynistic, a man is the one, of course, who has to run this demonic ring. He's a former minister from Salem Village. He's left under very contentious circumstances, obviously leaving some unfinished business behind him. And he's brought back. He's then in Maine, and he's brought back to stand trial.
And he maintained his innocence throughout. On the way to being executed, he recited the Lord's Prayer, which was supposed to be impossible for a wizard to be able to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Glenn, when you look at the court transcripts for the hearings, any number of suspects are asked to recite the Lord's Prayer, and almost to a man, he or she can't do it.
You'd think in this community they'd all know. I know
well,
how
they,
to.
No,
I
they
can
did.
Recite it.
It tells you about the stress they were under having to appear before the community and in front of these authorities, and they just couldn't get those few lines that were so familiar to them out.
So was that one of the reasons people felt that they should stop hanging these accused witches?
You know, this is like a mystery wrapped in a riddle here. There are so many enigmatic parts of the story. We're not entirely certain as to what slows things down at the end of the summer. The entire tragedy will take 9 months, really, from beginning to end. The number becomes an impossible number to prosecute, obviously. Many things have now come to a halt because everyone's busy in court, either testifying against or standing accused of witchcraft. The accusations have begun to reach a higher level, certainly, and some skeptics have begun to weigh in at last.
And then they stop. Do you think
they stop very suddenly? Exactly.
But do you think they had misgivings, and did they wonder about whether the people who had been hanged shouldn't have been hanged?
You know, it's interesting. There are misgivings, certainly. The belief that they have executed innocence will coincide with or coexist with the belief that witchcraft still exists and that they have possibly only eradicated the wrong people. It's really interesting. So, yes, the following year there are still cases of witchcraft.
What's the importance of the trials in our history? Because we have this phrase, witch hunt, used frequently, applied to a wide variety of issues. Do you feel that it's useful to link those things to a disgraceful moment in the past?
Yeah, I think it's hugely helpful. I mean, just it's nice to have that cautionary tale, that idea of what happens if you really do go to an extreme and begin to careen off the edge. Absolutely.
So how could a dog be a witch?
A dog could be a witch if it were a diabolical accomplice or a familiar of the witch. And one of those dogs, evidently, when it looks at the girls, sends them into spasms.
Stacy Schiff is a Pulitzer Prize winner. The book we've been discussing is The Witches, Salem 1692, published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Early the next morning, Peter woke to find a little bird perched on his windowsill. "Come out! Come out and play! It's a beautiful day!" With his new binoculars, Peter watched as the bird flew off, right over the hedge, toward the pool. Though Peter knew he was forbidden to enter the garden, today the temptation was just too strong. And so Peter opened the gate and went out into the big green garden.
When you hear the name Alice Cooper, what comes to mind? Perhaps legendary rock anthems like School's Out and I'm 18, or his onstage performances with a snake around his neck. Well, what about a musical composition by Sergei Prokofiev? This 2011 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee's foray into classical music may come as a surprise to some. In a recently released CD and iPad and iPhone app, Mr. Cooper not only narrates an updated version of Peter and the Wolf, called in this case Peter and the Wolf in Hollywood, but also performs the voice of each character in the Prokofiev piece. Alice Cooper joins us now to talk about this and some of his other projects. Welcome.
That's, you know, I told them when people ask why me, I said, well, Vincent Price is gone. Christopher Lee is gone.
But
I
you guess say, I'm but the your new voice guy. Is very good.
Well, thank you.
Had you ever considered acting?
Well, I've done acting before, you know, and mostly cast as the villain, which is fine. Uh-huh. I love being the villain. But this was brand new for me because you really had to, they let me create the voices for each character. And of course, when you've got an old grandfather from California that's an ex-hippie, the first thing that comes to my mind is Tommy Chong, you know. So he's got to be like that, you know. And the kid's not expecting his grandfather to be a hippie. He's thinking an old guy with white hair.
This is quite a departure from the Prokofiev version, which was set in Russia. This one allows you to do things like that.
An American version. And if you really think of it, most of the versions that I've ever heard were British. David Bowie, Sting, even back, I think Sir John Gielgud, I think so those guys all did it. And so you had a British, an immediate authority to it, because the British accent does that. The American version of him being in California, suddenly you want an American to do it. That lived in California. So it is kind of unique to have it, to do an American version of this.
Do you remember the first time you heard it?
Oh, when I was like 10 years old, I think, you know, all of us, Peter Pan, Peter and the Wolf, you know, I mean, Wizard of Oz, it was a standard. And we didn't really even know we were listening to classic music. All we knew is it was nice music.
But it's something that sticks with us. I know the first, when we said we were going to do this with you and Peter and the Wolf, the first thing that I thought of was, it just comes to you because it's so much a part of our history.
It's a signature, you know, and I think that that guitar, that's going to end up in a guitar line somewhere in the show.
Uh-huh. Somebody's going to sample it, maybe.
Well, I'm just going to tell the guys in the band, you know, somewhere this can fit in. I don't know where, but somewhere.
The original version of Peter and the Wolf was conceived by Prokofiev as a way to teach children about the elements of classical music, and each character in the story is represented by an instrument. What instruments are used to represent each character in this update?
You know, I don't think it's changed at all. I think they use the same formula. What I was getting out of it, being a lyricist, was looking at the actual spoken word of it. I am much more lyrically oriented. And I kind of was seeing the metaphors of, here's the only kid in the only character in the whole play that's not afraid of the wolf is Peter. And I kind of looked at the wolf as being, in modern days, the bully. And he's not afraid of the bully. And I said, that's a good lesson right there. The fact that the little kid is not afraid of the bully. In fact, he goes after him. He's not going to be intimidated by the wolf. So I can see how that would relate to a kid today.
This, you've augmented the Prokofiev score with other things. What did you do?
They actually brought the music to me. They brought it to me, and I listened to it, and I noticed that there was, you know, that they played around with it a little bit like that. But I said, look, I'm going to interpret this lyrically, and I'm going to try to put the voices in to make this thing come alive. So musically, really, that's yours. But what I loved what they did with it is they invented their own world. They literally cut these things out with, you know, cardboard, painted it, and it gave it a surrealistic look that I had never seen before. Because your animation now is so good, Pixar. You know, I mean, the Pixar and everybody do such amazing things with animation. And this was primitive, and that's what I kind of dug about it. It really had that unique look.
But not the orchestra, the National Youth Orchestra of Germany. They're
young kids.
Great.
Yeah, young kids.
They're just kids?
Yeah, and you know, I'll tell you, I played with another orchestra very similar to this. There was a thing where it was lead singers that would do their songs with an orchestra behind them, and it was the Prague Orchestra. And these were all goth kids that happened to be prodigies on their instruments. And you'd get there, and you'd look at all these kids going, how good could they be? They were amazing. These kids were all excellent oboe players and bassoon players. And, you know, when you look at them, you would really not judge them as being that at all.
Well, there you hear the influence of classical music on any number of rock performers over the years.
George Martin brought it to the Beatles. I mean, he was totally classic music. Procol Harum.
Pink Floyd.
Procol Harum was probably the most pronounced one. That, I mean, they were just obviously very steeped in it.
The Procol Harum, it starts off with what sounds like a Bach fugue.
Oh, very much so. In fact, almost in every song. There's something like that.
How important
King
was
Crimson.
Classical music to you? King Crimson? Yeah. How much was classical music a part of your life as a child?
Not much at all, because my dad was swing. My dad loved big band, and he played saxophone. Played with Artie Shaw a couple times, and I grew up in the era of the 50s, so I loved the Four Seasons and doo-wop and that stuff when I was 10, 11, 12 years old.
You're not
Beach
talking
Boys.
About Vivaldi's Four Seasons. You're talking about the Jersey's pulses.
the real Four Seasons. And then, of course, I was 15 when the Beatles came out, and that's what made me just go, oh, I've got to do this.
So what changed? Can you talk about your 2014 Cooper's Rock Meets Classic tour?
Yeah, that was one of those things where we had the Prague Orchestra. And it's a very odd thing. If you're used to hearing a five-man electrical band behind you, amps, guitars, even great keyboards that, you know, do all these things, when you first hear your song with a 90-piece orchestra behind you, it's shocking. Yeah, it's you go, it takes your breath away because you're not expecting it. And it actually had to get used to it. We did about 20 shows, I think, through Europe. And every single night when they would start up with Poison or some one of these songs that would swell up like that, I go, wow, how can we do this? I want to steal that for my show, but it wouldn't work.
Who are the creators behind this project?
The guys that they're from Giants Are Small. And these guys have done some interesting things. They've done opera. They create their own. It's almost Hell's a Poppin'. Mm-hmm. You know, they have an orchestra, and then they have these opera characters, and they're very surrealistic. And they use every media that you could possibly use when you're not expecting it. And they showed me a few of their operas that they did. I just went, this is really good. I mean, this is something that Salvador Dali might think of, you know. Brilliant stuff.
And they obviously were aware of you. They probably heard you do characters on your Nights with Alice Cooper radio show.
That's always fun, yeah.
Will you tell us a bit about your newly released Wish You Were Here symphonic?
You know, Pink Floyd, we go way back with Pink Floyd. I'll tell you a great story. When you're a young band, you never know who's going to make it. You just don't. You're a bunch of bands that are starving, trying to make it. And we get to the Whiskey A Go-Go one night, and we look up. We finally get into the whiskey. That's the big deal. And it says Alice Cooper, and I said, who's Led Zeppelin? That was the band that was coming in. The guys walked in, and I looked at Jimmy Page, and I went, that guy was in the Yardbirds, and they were our favorite band. Mm-hmm. You know, the next night, we're playing the Cheetah Club, and I look up, and it says Alice Cooper and Pink Floyd. I said, it must be a guy named Floyd that painted himself pink. And we ended up being best of friends. They ran out of money and moved in with us. So we lived together when Syd Barrett was in the band. This was the early, early, early Pink Floyd. So for it to come full circle and for them to come to me and ask me to do a couple of Pink Floyd songs, I went, that's a bit unusual for me to sing these kind of songs. But yeah, I'll try it, you know. It was fun to do, but it was a challenge. Their songs are not easy to sing.
Did you ever think about the dangers in the Led Zeppelin name? You don't want to have any drink lead, and you definitely don't want to fly in a Zeppelin.
You know, they got the name for Keith Moon. They were going to be called the New Yardbirds, and Keith Moon said, that's going to go over like a Led Zeppelin. And then they went, that's even a better name.
You recently performed at the Grammy Awards ceremony as the lead singer of the Hollywood Vampires. Who else is in that group?
Well, Johnny Depp plays guitar. Joe Perry from Aerosmith. We have Duff McKagan on bass from Guns N' Roses, and Matt Sorn. And it grew from. I was doing a movie with Johnny Depp called Dark Shadows, and we played a little club where we just were one night. I said, we're going to go into this club. We're just going to be a jam bar band. Come on and play with us, because I knew Johnny could play guitar. And he got up there and just killed it. You know, I started telling him about my drinking club called the Hollywood Vampires. Every night we'd meet at the Rainbow, and it was Harry Nilsson, John Lennon was there, Keith Moon was there, Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees was there. Every night the same guys. All of them passed away except for Mickey, you know. And I said, why don't we do an album for our dead drunk friends? Because these guys were all guys we drank with. And I said, it'd be a great idea. Joe Perry walks in and says, I'm in.
But is it easy for people who come from such different musical styles to just get together and meld?
Johnny Depp was a guitar player way before he was an actor. He's been playing guitar since he was 10 years old. In fact, Joe Perry always says, I take guitar lessons from Johnny. When he did that movie, Chocolat, it was basically gypsy jazz, and everybody thought that somebody else was playing and he was faking it. That was actually him playing. And when Joe saw that, Joe went, are you kidding me? He says, that's Django Reinhardt stuff. He said, I can't play that. And so he was taking lessons from Johnny. So for people that don't think Johnny can play, Johnny can really play.
I always thought it was hard to play guitar with scissor hands.
Yeah. Cuts a lot of strings, yeah.
Well, anyway, this is a lot of fun, this project, and I thank you so much for coming by to talk about it. Alice Cooper, Peter and the Wolf in Hollywood, narrated by Alice Cooper. It's on Deutsche Grammophon, and it's also available As an iPad and a phone app.
There's games that you can play with it. I am a technotard, I'll be honest with you.
It's a generational thing.
Oh, it is. Yeah, my daughters and sons can do everything, you know, but I can't.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Excellent. Thank you.